I want to talk about one of the strangest eras in human history, a time when the world was lurching from something that would have bewildered us to something that we could just about begin to understand. In the year 1600, an Italian philosopher and mystic named Giordano Bruno declared that the Earth was only one of infinitely many planets. The Inquisition threw him in jail, dragged him from his cell, paraded him through the streets, tied him to a stake, burned him alive to make sure he didn't manage to utter any final heresies. They drove a metal spike through his tongue. That was 1600. Almost exactly a century later, in 1725, the Queen of England knighted Isaac Newton. When Newton eventually died, earls and dukes carried his casket. He received what was essentially a royal funeral. Among the achievements that won Newton universal fame was this. He had convinced the world of the doctrine that had cost Bruno his life. Sometime between those two events, I think it was around 1660, the modern world was born. So I want to talk about history and science and new ideas, especially new ideas. What I hope to convey is what it was like to look through a microscope or a telescope for the first time, when nobody knew what you would see. Nobody had ever done it before, and now someone was going to do this, and they were astonished at what they saw. But I don't want to talk about these new ideas the way that you usually talk about them, because I think that the conventional history of these notions often gets it wrong. When we talk about the great scientists of past centuries, Galileo, Newton, Kepler, there's a tendency to talk about them as if they were people from our era who just happened to live in the past. They were just like us, they were time travelers, they were like us, except that they wore funny wigs. They were not just like us. Take Robert Boyle. Boyle was one of the most eminent scientists in England in the generation just before Newton. You may remember his name from high school chemistry, from Boyle's Law. Or you may not. Boyle was a brilliant man, kind-hearted, immensely rich, interested in everything under the sun. One of the things he was interested in was dead men and hangings. Hangings in England in the 1600s were a big deal. They were huge crowd pleasers. On hanging days, which was eight times a year, holidays for everybody to gather together for the fun, you might get 20,000 spectators around the gallows. Rich people would sit in bleachers, the poor would stand and elbow one another for a better view. The gallows had room for 24 swaying bodies at a time. Nobody had any qualms about hangings, I should say. There were already liberals and conservatives. If you were a liberal, you thought it was fine if you knew somebody being hanged, if you would rush up to him and grab him by the feet and yank him down so that he would die a little bit faster. If you were a conservative, you were opposed to that. That's too soft. I thought this was supposed to be a punishment. For most people, the hanging itself was the spectacle, was lore enough. Boyle knew better than that. One of the hangman's perks was the right to auction off souvenirs, death ropes sold in 1 foot lengths. But the most prized souvenir of all was an executed prisoner's severed hands, because death sweat held the power to heal. Robert Boyle, one of the titans in the scientific pantheon, thought that death sweat was one of the most valuable weapons in a physician's arsenal. Boyle and Newton and all the other scientists of their day shared a mental landscape. They all lived precariously between the medieval world they had grown up in and a new world that they had just begun to glimpse. These were brilliant, ambitious, confused, conflicted men. They believed in angels and alchemy and the devil, and they believed that the universe was governed by precise mathematical law. If we could travel to the 1600s, a huge number of things would startle us. The piles of human waste blocking the street, the body parts of executed criminals tacked up around town as a warning to others to be careful. But many of the biggest differences between now and then had to do with what people believed, not with what they did. One of the crucial differences was in how our forefathers thought of God. This affected everything. The 17th century was a God-drenched society. God was everywhere. Nowadays, when something tragic happens, we try to console one another by saying that everything happens for a reason. Our forebears literally believed that everything happened for a reason, and the reason was always the same. God had willed it so. Even today, insurance policies still talk about floods and earthquakes as acts of God. But for our forebears, everything was an act of God. Scientists believe that just as deeply as everyone else. The expression, "it just so happens," wouldn't have made any sense to them. So that was one aspect of this all-pervasive belief in God. There couldn't be anything that just happened. But there was another side of things that was just as important if we're to catch on to the mental world that our ancestors lived in. And that was this. This was a God-fearing society in the most literal sense. The world was a terrifying place. We live with such a watered-down version of those beliefs that it's hard to picture the real thing. For us, hell and damn are the mildest of oaths. It's suitable to stubbing your toe or to spilling a drink. In the 1600s, hell was a real terrifying place, and to be damned was a gruesome fate. Every detail had been thought of up for maximum horror. The point of burning eternally, for instance, was that you did burn eternally. It wasn't simply that you were burned alive, but that your flesh was never consumed so that the burning could continue unrelieved and the pain could endure forever. God watched every sparrow that falls, and he watched each of us at every moment, and he wasn't too thrilled with what he saw. Some of you will remember Jonathan Edwards' sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Edwards would look down on his cowering congregation. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. That was standard doctrine. Now, what did it have to do with science? What it had to do with science was this. The mission of science was to study God's handiwork, to pay homage to his creation. Every feature of the world, why there's one sun and not two, why the ocean is salty, why lobster is delicious, why one man died of plague and another didn't, everything reflected an explicit decision by God. Since God had fashioned the universe in its every aspect, to do science meant to read the mind of God. There was no separating science and religion. And that meant, among other things, that the job of a scientist was just as much to study the Bible as to study the natural world. Both were God's work. Every word in the Bible was a clue to God's intent, just as every twig in the natural world was a clue to his craftsmanship. So the Bible was not a literary work to be interpreted according to philosophy or taste, but a cipher with a single meaning that could be decoded by a meticulous and brilliant analyst.